What does it mean when the Utah Attorney General joins an amicus brief or signs on to a letter centered on a provocative topic? Hello, I'm Richard Pyatt, and this is Legally Speaking. In any given month, the Utah AG's office has the opportunity to join on to dozens of amici, also known as friend of the court briefs, or sign the AG's name to a persuasive letter that argues for or against a hot topic. Does this do any good? And does it saddle taxpayers with financial obligations? Joining me now to discuss this is Christopher Bates, Deputy Solicitor General in our office, who helps decide whether Utah joins these causes. Thanks for joining Legally Speaking, Chris.
Thanks for inviting me.
For both amicus briefs and the sign-on letters, it seems like it's a sort of a strength in numbers game. Is that a good point of view to way to look at this thing?
So certainly when we author amicus briefs and send around comment letters, we are, as an office, looking to get a strong coalition to join us. And so, of course, when other offices send around briefs and letters, they're likewise looking for a strong coalition. And that's important, I think, largely in part because the more states you have on these briefs and letters, the stronger the signal is to the court or to the agency that this is an important issue, that this is an important way of looking at the issue or at the case that may not have been raised by the parties, and that the court or the agency should pay attention to.
We were talking about the different kinds of topics that are generally the subject of these. Some of them are really hot right now in general in the political realm, including things like abortion, air quality, healthcare, transgender issues, immigration, federal regulation. Are these efforts necessarily political, or are these issues that legally our office is interested in anyway just because of what's going on in society?
So it's certainly the case that the briefs and letters on, you know, what you might call the hottest topics probably get the most news attention, but there are numerous briefs and letters that we do that aren't on such politically hot topics. For instance, we had one just this week that we signed on to in the Supreme Court about what's called differential pay for military reservists. So when folks who are in the reserves get called up to active duty, under certain circumstances, they get paid to make up for the fact that their reserve pay is less than what they get paid during their regular job. You know, that's not one of these politically controversial issues. You're probably not going to see a bunch of news stories about that brief, but there are many issues like that that aren't quite as politically hot that we come across our desk all the time that we sign on to that you don't see as much in the news. So I guess that's probably the first thing to emphasize is these sort of hot issues is what maybe you see more news reports about, but there are numerous ones that aren't nearly as politically hot where we're looking at them just the same, trying to assess the legal merits, the importance of the issue. And even on those that might be considered more politically sensitive, you know, when we're looking at these, we're thinking about, is this issue important to Utah? And if this case goes one way or the other, how is that going to impact our state? What sort of precedent is that going to set? And particularly in cases where you're thinking about challenges to agency action, cases that implicate federalism concerns, where we might be concerned about the federal government overreaching and sort of crowding out states' ability to regulate or make decisions in certain areas. Yes, those particular issues might implicate hot button issues, but there's also more general questions at stake about federalism or about the separation of powers that are equally important, I would say, in those cases, beyond, you know, it's the specific issue that's under consideration.
It seems the more that I learn about this, it's helpful for us to take these on because they're issues, whether they happen to be hot in the news or the subject of talk shows or not, or if it's in the case of something like differential pay. These are issues that people in our state are dealing with and that people in other states are dealing with. And we're essentially saying, let's get together and we have a common point of view. Let's argue these cases legally on behalf of each other. And then we all don't have to reinvent the wheel in every single state individually, right?
One thing that's important to keep in mind as well, sometimes people wonder, okay, this is a case that is in, you know, a court in another state. So our federal court of appeals here in Utah is the 10th Circuit. You may have cases in the Federal Court of Appeals in Ohio, which is the 6th Circuit, or in Richmond, Virginia, which is the 4th Circuit. Sometimes people might wonder, why are we signing on to amicus briefs in the 6th Circuit or the 4th Circuit, or famously the 9th Circuit, when decisions in those courts aren't necessarily binding on our 10th Circuit or on our federal trial courts here in Utah? Well, one really important reason why we do that is because even if those decisions aren't binding, you know, specifically in the 10th Circuit, if the case comes out a bad way and there's a bad precedent, our courts will look to those other decisions for what's called persuasive authority. So even then, if they aren't necessarily going to be bound by that decision, the fact that you might have a bad decision out of another court can be bad for Utah, because our Utah courts might look to that bad decision as persuasive authority and decide to follow it.
So it's kind of a way of cutting to the chase and maybe creating a little bit of a shortcut. Would you agree?
In terms of issues where we think there's a pretty decent chance it'll ultimately come before the Tenth Circuit or a Utah court, certainly it's a way for us to start thinking about the issue and start working with other states to lay groundwork for when the issue comes to Utah, both for us as an office and for other states that might be looking to support our efforts here in Utah as amici. But again, as I said too, like, we always have to be concerned about what sorts of precedents are going to be set in other courts that our courts might look to as persuasive authority and think, hey, the Sixth Circuit decided it this way, maybe we should follow it.
So in this way, and perhaps in some other ways, does joining these benefit the people of Utah, would you say?
Certainly. Certainly on issues where there are court cases on the issue already underway in Utah, joining amicus briefs in other courts is helpful because, as I've explained, it can help to forestall bad precedent in those other states that our Utah courts might then decide to follow. And even on issues that haven't yet reached Utah. So maybe you have some laws that are being passed in other states that are being challenged. Utah hasn't yet passed that law, but maybe our legislature has been looking at it. Maybe some bills have been introduced, haven't passed yet, but our legislature is looking at it. We can expect that if our legislature does pass those laws, there will be similar challenges in Utah as there have been in other states. So we can look to what's happening in those other states in those suits to kind of give us guidance about what might happen here, the arguments people might make to challenge those laws when they are, if and when they are passed in Utah. And again, our efforts to get amicus support in Utah to help to show our Utah courts that, hey, there are other states that have already looked at this issue. This is what those states think about this issue, you know, and therefore we encourage you Utah courts to, follow what other states have done in looking at this issue.
Has this system of states joining together on amici or on sign-on letters, has this been going on for a while? It seems like a relatively new thing, but maybe that's because I didn't know about it. Do you know if there's a history of this? Has this kind of joining in forces been a practice for a long time?
So, you know, I don't know exactly when the first multi-state amicus, brief got filed in the Supreme Court or in the Court of Appeals. Certainly I would say it's been getting more attention probably in the last 5, 6, 7 years, but amicus briefs have been around for a very long time. I'm sure if you go back 10, 20 more years, you would find amicus briefs in the Supreme Court and other courts where there have been, multiple states joining on. Certainly letters sent to agencies expressing concerns about rulemakings that agencies are thinking about. Those have been going on for a long time too, because the way it works when an agency issues a rule, they have to respond to the comments that were submitted to the agency when they were thinking about that rule. And that's one of the main reasons that we do these comment letters to agencies, because we want our views laid out so that A, the agency has to consider that rule, those views when it issues the rule, but also it has to respond to those views. And if the agency ignores those views or those comments, that gives us grounds to later challenge the rule. So it's a way for us to lay the groundwork for a future legal challenge to an agency rulemaking. So, that's under something called the Administrative Procedure Act, which has been around for decades. And so the idea that it's important to submit comments to lay the groundwork for a potential legal challenge to a rule that you're really concerned about, that's nothing new. In terms of, the volume or how much attention these amicus briefs and comment letters get, my guess is it probably gets more attention now, and maybe there's more of it than there was in the past. Of course, also the number of cases that get filed in court, it goes up each year. So that volume has also increased as well. So there might be, there might be more briefs, more letters, more states signing on, but it's not like this all started 5 years ago and it never happened before. And one last point on that, in terms of the comment letters. So these are letters that we send to agencies, as I said, expressing concerns about proposed rulemakings. The reason we're seeing a lot more of those is because the federal government and federal agencies are doing a lot more than they used to do 10, 20, 30 years ago. We can have debates about whether that's a good thing or not, but certainly as federal agencies become more and more active, seeking to regulate more and more aspects of our lives, states and other interested parties are going to be submitting more comment letters in response, because there's more to be pushing back on when agencies are doing things that we don't think are right.
That's a good point. And you're right, it is getting a lot of attention and politically has been getting more attention because of what a lot of people perceive as the cost. So I wanted to ask you if just signing on to a letter or an amicus brief cost anything. People are concerned about our office devoting resources to an issue that maybe they don't agree with, or concerned that we're not heading down the right path. So is there really a cost to the office to signing on to these?
So certainly when we sign on to a brief or to a comment letter, you know, there's no, you know, we're not paying out money as an office to do that. You know, you don't have to, there's no like filing fee that we are paying as an office to join to a brief or a comment letter. Obviously, it takes some time to review them. So when the briefs come in or the comment letters come in, I and others in the office review them. There's a multi-stage review process depending on the issue that's involved. We may send it to certain subject matter experts in the office. If it's, you know, a consumer protection issue, we'll send it to the consumer protection folks, the folks who represent the Division of Consumer Protection. If it's environmental issue, we might send to the folks who represent, for instance, the Division of Air Quality, and then they'll take a look and send us a recommendation. So, you know, certainly we are very careful in our review to make sure that the decisions on whether to join are well thought out and are right. You know, so there is some time, and, you know, that's time that might be spent perhaps on other uses and other circumstances. But that's the case with everything that the office does. You know, we get requests from citizens as well. You know, it takes time to consider and to respond to those requests when we're writing briefs, when we're reviewing briefs internally. It takes time to write and to review those briefs. And as I've said, these amicus briefs and these comment letters, they do an important thing. They help to avoid bad precedent or help to set good precedent in other courts. They express our views to agencies about rulemakings that may be very problematic. They're an important part of our representing the people of the state of Utah, because they're making our voice known, as I, you know, to other courts, to agencies, in ways that are important and can have significant consequences for the people of Utah. So it's really part and parcel of the office's work of representing the people of Utah. It's just a different way that we make our voice as an office representing the people of Utah, their voice heard.
I think you could look at it potentially as maybe an efficiency thing too, because if it's out there, chances are the state's going to have to deal with it sooner or later. We're kind of taking it on, you know, as it's out there in the legal world. It may not necessarily directly affect Utah at this moment, but the potential is high for it coming, because a lot of states share some of the same concerns.
Certainly. And many of these cases also eventually wind their way up to the Supreme Court. And of course, when the Supreme Court issues rules, those rules do bind everywhere, including Utah. So another part of this as well is our thinking about what are the cases that are working their way up to the Supreme Court. How are those cases going to impact Utah when they get to the Supreme Court? And maybe there's some important groundwork that we can lay at an earlier stage of the case, when it's before the Court of Appeals, before it gets up to the Supreme Court. And then, of course, once it is in the Supreme Court, of course, we want to make our voice heard, because, again, the way that the Supreme Court rules on the issue is going to directly impact Utah.
Okay. So what's the, when a join request comes in, how do we go about deciding whether or not we want to join it? What's the process there?
So we look at, you know, whether it's a brief or a comment letter to an agency, you know, we look at it. So the first question is, how are the arguments? Do the arguments seem right? Do there seem any issues with the arguments? As I mentioned earlier, if it implicates an area where there are some real subject matter experts in the office, so I use the examples of consumer protection, environmental quality. There are many other issues, of course, where there are attorneys in the office, there are subject matter experts. We'll send it to them for their review, because they're, of course, deeper in the weeds on the issues than I am or than other of my colleagues are in the office. So we'll get their perspective on the legal arguments in the brief or in the letter, the importance of the issue to our office and to the people of Utah. So we have an internal review sort of about the merits of the legal position. We also think about, is this an issue that's important to Utah, because it's either, you know, currently at issue in our courts in Utah or before the legislature, or is it an issue that we think maybe headed to Utah? I talked about how sometimes you have other states that have started passing laws on certain issues. Utah hasn't yet passed a law, but it's sort of percolating in the legislature, and so we know this is an issue that's either already present in Utah or will soon be present in Utah. So we think about that as well, and, you know, the importance and, you know, the merits of the arguments being made, and then make a decision based on that.
Okay, it's all very interesting, and we keep hearing more about amicus briefs, and we will continue to, and I appreciate the education on that.
Thank you.
All right, Chris, thanks for joining Legally Speaking today, and we will talk to you next time.